down the narrow, empty side street where I left my car parked between two palm trees.
What happened?
He asks.
Are you okay?
Something in me snaps. I whirl back around on him. Are you trying to embarrass me, Hayden? Shock splashes across his face.
What?
I stalk toward him. It wasn't enough for you to kiss me, and let's be clear here, you kissed me, shut me down, and insult my ability? You had to show up here tonight to, what, ruin my date? Or did you not even believe I had a date? Well, guess what? You win, I don't. He's not coming after all. He, like you, changed his mind at the last second. I guess I have that effect on a certain kind of man, so if you're done chasing me down the street to get a good look at my humiliation, I'd love to go home right now and pretend this night, this whole last week, never happened. I spin toward my car. He grabs my arm. My gaze snaps from his loose grip up to his face, hovering over me and torqued in frustration. I wait for him to say something, or to let go. 1 second. Two. Three. It's like we're both frozen there.
I thought you invited me,
he blurts. What? He huffs, eyes dropping to our feet before rebounding to my face.
I thought you were kidding about the date.
I stare at him, utterly shocked.
Not because I don't believe you could get a date,
he goes on gruffly.
Just because we've only been here a week and a half, and almost everyone who lives on this island is a retiree.
I'm still staring, blinking at him, mouth open like a goldfish who accidentally plopped out of her fish tank.
So I thought, when you said...
He grimaces.
You don't have anything to be embarrassed about here, Alice. I know I'm the one who kissed you. I know I'm the one who shut it down.
I still haven't regained control of my voice, or my limbs. His hand softens on my elbow, and I do everything I can not to lean into the touch, to find comfort there.
There's something I have to tell you,
he says, shaking his head. I finally manage a small, okay. Once more, his dark gaze sweeps toward the gap between our feet.
She asked for me.
Our eyes connect. What do you mean?
I didn't track Margaret Ives down,
he says.
You're the only one who found her.
I sway slightly on the spot.
She found me, he says. She reached out to my agent. I guess she read our friend Len and she asked if I'd be open to doing some meetings to see whether I'd be a good fit to write her biography.
My legs wobble. Hayden's grip on me tightens slightly as I lean back, slowing my fall as I slump against the side of my car. He steps in close, balancing me for a second, before his hands uncertainly release me. So she's already chosen, I half whisper.
No,
he says quietly, but when I meet his eyes, he looks down.
I don't know. Maybe.
Now I'm the one to study our feet, both of mine in between both of his. You could have told me sooner. He sighs.
I felt bad. You did all the work of finding her, and then I just showed up.
Why did she even have me come down here? I ask, shaking my head, tears well in my eyes. A snort of laughter escapes me when I realize. Long day. I say, wiping at the damp spots in my tear trough. With a frown, Hayden touches the side of my face, a gentle slide of his palm and then a sweep of his thumb over the top of my cheek, collecting the moisture.
You wouldn't be here if she wasn't still open to working with you.
Yeah, I say half-heartedly. He's right, though. He has to be. There has to be a reason I'm here. Or maybe it's all some kind of game to her. Maybe she's just using me to try and get your best work or something.
I don't know, he admits. But I started with an advantage. It didn't feel right kissing you when you didn't know the full story.
I look up into his eyes. That's why? His hand curves softly around my ear.
That's why.
Delicate warmth unfurls through my belly. No girlfriend?
No girlfriend,
he says.
And your date?
Real, I say. But not a boyfriend. I straighten away from the car, the movement pressing me against him.
This still wouldn't work, Alice.
His voice rumbles through my stomach and my hip, where his free hand has settled. What wouldn't? I ask. His eyes track the rise and fall of my breath.
We're still competing for the same job.
So I'm competition again? I tease. His hand flexes at my waist, and I'm pulled snug against him, where I can feel every hard line of him.
You were always competition.
I'm going to kiss you, Hayden, I say, almost a warning. But I don't get the chance. His mouth is already on mine, one of his hands snaking into my hair, his other sliding down my backside as I arch hungrily into him. I'm pinned against the car, gasping into his mouth, my thigh lifted up along his hip on this abandoned street. His long fingers curl into my skin. His hand slides higher, pushing my skirt up along my thigh, moving closer and closer to where I want him. He brushes along the damp lace of my underwear and swears against the side of my throat.
You never wear pants,
he murmurs, his thumb tracing down me.
It makes it hard to think.
You always wear pants, I manage to breathe out. I'm worried you'll have heat stroke. His laugh is gravelly at my ear, the sound sending as much of a thrill through me as his careful touch. I move against him, and he slides his hand down me more fully. A jumble of voices and footsteps approach us from around the corner, and he steps back abruptly, smoothing my skirt down my thighs again. You can come over if you want, I say thickly.
Stop inviting me,
he says. Why? I ask.
Because eventually I'm going to say yes,
he replies. That's the general idea, I say.
I'm obviously attracted to you,
he says. Obviously, I agree.
This can't go well, Alice,
he says. Which part? I ask, doubtful. There's at least one thing I'm very nearly certain could go well.
We both want this job too much,
he says.
Even more than we might want.
You're worried I'll get too attached, I guess.
I'm worried about the work,
he says.
Neither of us can afford to be pulling punches here. If either of us doesn't give this our all, we'll regret it, and then we'll resent each other for it. And I don't know if I can handle being the one person on the planet Alice Scott doesn't like.
Oh, I'm sure you could, I tell him. His smile, wide enough to reveal teeth, dazzles me for a moment. I want to climb inside of it. The group that came from around the corner staggers tipsily past. When they've moved off, he steps in close again, our waists connecting, the infinitesimal amount of pressure flooding me with want.
Maybe some other time,
he says, the rest of the sentence hanging in the air, unspoken.
After all of this.
Maybe, I agree.
Would you be able to forgive me?
He asks, looking up at me through his lashes. Of course I wouldn't hold it against him if he got the job. But would I be able to handle the way his presence would remind me of my failure? Would you? I ask him, rather than answering. He frowns, and I can see it in his face. For all of our differences, we're both proud. This spark between us is fun and surprising right now. In 3 more weeks, it could settle into something bitter. Okay. My nod feels strangely final, like a handshake agreement. May the best writer win, and may it be enough to make up for the orgasms we forsake. He steps back from the curb, and I straighten, pulling my keys free from the outside pocket of my bag. He gives me the same kind of nod.
Get home safe.
The formality of it makes my heart twinge. You too. I turn and round my car, unlocking it.
Alice?
He calls over the top of it.
Hmm?
She lies to me too, he says. For whatever it's worth, Margaret Ives isn't telling me the truth. 14. On Monday, I'm working over dinner at Rum Room when I find something strange. I'm prepping for tomorrow's interview with Margaret to continue her grandfather's story after his affair with the actress Nina Gill ended, and I come across a news item in Vanity Fair covering the opulent 1949 wedding of Gerald's niece, Ruth Allen, the little princess he'd raised more devotedly than his own children. Ruth was 21 years old when she married the actor-turned-decorated World War II pilot-turned-talent manager, James Aller, and their wedding was the event of the summer. Starlets, politicians, famous artists of all stripes descended on the grounds of the House of Ives to celebrate the union. Margaret and her sister Laura, 11 and 8 years old at the time, acted as flower girls for their first cousin once removed, wearing crowns of vibrant yellow sunflowers to match Ruth's bouquet. Even Nina Gill, accompanied by her husband, had attended, sitting on the same expansive lawn as Gerald for the first time since their affair ended 22 years earlier. The wedding festivities lasted 3 days and were completely devoid of photography, which made every society journalist covering the affair that much more committed to making the reader feel as though she were there. It's effective. I've read 4 articles about the wedding back to back, my food going cold on the table at Rum Room, when I hit on the thing that jolts me back to the present, to my reality. It's a line that contains Ruth's middle name. Not legal middle name. A quick search tells me she doesn't have one officially. But apparently, among close family, her full name was Ruth Nicolette Ives Allen. A sizzle of recognition goes down my spine. Where do I know that name from? It only takes a second to hit me. I scroll back through my notes, double-checking. The very first inn that Lawrence Richard Ives purchased to capitalize on other prospectors once he'd struck silver ore. Margaret had called it the Ebner. When Lawrence had first bought it, it was called the Arledge, and then, for a chunk of time in between that, just like I thought, the Nicolette. Same spelling and everything. Coincidence? Or is Nicolette a family name? But if it is, it makes even less sense that Margaret referred to the hotel by its current name. Nicolette should have been burned into her brain. I do a quick search of Nicolette paired with Lawrence Ives, and the results are scant. The only thing of note is the website for the current-day Ebner, whose history page proudly declares its former ownership by the famed family, where it also lists its previous monikers. I shake my head. Most likely, Margaret read something years ago about the Nicolette's new name and simply called it by its latest name because that was what came to mind. And maybe Nicolette is a family name, but not one she's familiar with. It's a far more likely explanation than the one my brain keeps circling. That Margaret Ives doesn't want me looking closely at that hotel, even as she pretends to bear the Ives family's history and soul. What Hayden said keeps replaying in my mind. Margaret Ives isn't telling me the truth. I shovel some now cold lobster mac into my mouth and pull up the email address for the Ebner Hotel. On Tuesday, we're sitting out back in Adirondack chairs, sipping more of Jody's incredible mint lemonade, and I decide to take a big swing. What's significant about the name Nicolette? I ask. Margaret's glass clinks against her teeth. Rather than follow through with her sip, she returns the glass to the arm of her chair. What do you mean? She says. Her tone is so innocent that if not for that flicker of surprise and her reaction, I'd be sure I'd read too much into nothing. The Ebner Hotel, I say. It was called the Nicolette for a long stretch of time when your family owned it, and Ruth Ives Allen's unofficial middle name was Nicolette. Her head cocks like she's trying to anticipate where this is going. I'm curious why you'd call the inn by its new name, I explain. Have you been there recently? I disregard the fact that she's already told me she hasn't. If she wants to give me new information now, I don't want to call her a liar for withholding it earlier. She considers for a beat, her eye contact unyielding. Then she sighs. I suppose you'll find out now, one way or another. Probably, I agree. But remember, I've signed a non-disclosure. I'm not going to force you to publicly share anything you don't want to. Whatever you tell me, it doesn't have to go beyond this room. Her eyes narrow. Then, slowly, she leans forward and stops both of my recorders. This includes the boy. What boy? I ask. I have two NDAs, she says. So whatever I tell you, you can't take it to him. You understand that, don't you? The word boy is so wrong that it takes me 30 seconds to track her train of thought. Are we talking about Hayden here? She nods. You've known I was here for months and no one else has tracked me down, which makes me think I can trust you. But him, I'm not so sure of. I'm still figuring him out. I'm surprised by the swell of protectiveness in my gut. You can trust him too. He won't break your confidence. One of her silvery brows curves. It tugs on her lips, pulling her mouth into a sly smile. Oh? So you're campaigning for him to get the job now? Oh, definitely not, I say quickly. I want this, and I'll do a great job. I know that. You can trust him. That's all.
I'll take that under advisement, she says. But still, my point remains. You're about to be the first person outside of my immediate family to hear something, and I don't want it going any further just yet.
I set my pen down. I swear. She gathers herself for a second.
My grandfather, Gerald, was the one to rename the inn in 1919.
The year your great-grandfather Lawrence died. I point out, I noticed the correlation while I was on the Arledge Nicolette Ebner's history webpage. Margaret nods.
I told you that in those final days of Lawrence's life, he was raving to his former business partner and apologizing to his little brother, but there was one more thing he kept saying.
A look of resolve steals over her, her shoulders relaxing as if whatever she's just decided to share has given her some measure of relief.
Nicolette.
I've read it dozens of times in the last couple of days, but still the way she says it, almost reverentially, sends goosebumps prickling down my arms. Who was that?
The one it was all for.
The corner of her mouth twitches into a smile, small and fleeting.
That's what Lawrence told her. Nicolette, this was all for you. Tell me to come home and I'll leave all of this behind. Gerald had never even heard his father say the name before, and he only found out who Nicolette was after Lawrence died, when Gerald read his father's journals.
A lover, I think, at first, but then it dawns on me. His sister. She nods confirmation.
In my family, that's what the name came to represent. The person you'd do anything for. The only one who could make you give it all up. That's why they gave Ruth that middle name.
My chest pinches. That's beautiful. I mean it, but it doesn't answer the question. Why didn't you just tell me about that? She studies me, another small smile unfurling over her lips.
And here I thought you'd already figured it out.
I hadn't, evidently, but there's nothing like a challenge to get your brain turning, and as soon as she says it, my mind turns into a primetime police procedural serial killer board, pinning details and suspects together with little bits of red string. Ruth's mother, Gigi Ives Allen, wasn't in the room with her father when he died. She wasn't even in the country until well after her father died. Only Gerald was there, at their father Lawrence's bedside, to hear his ranting about Dickie and Thomas and Nicolette. Only Gerald had read their father's diaries. Then he'd fled the rest of his family shortly after Lawrence's death. He'd met Nina in Los Angeles, and they'd passed nearly a decade together before her mystery illness took her overseas and she married someone else. Right around the time Ruth Ives Allen was born. She wasn't Gigi's daughter, I blurt before I'm even sure of it.
Margaret doesn't look scandalized or even surprised by the theory. If anything, she looks a little satisfied, slightly smirky.
I knew you'd get there, she says approvingly.
Nina's mystery illness, I say. The time spent in the Alps, it was a pregnancy?
9 months would have been too suspicious, Margaret explains. They had to drag it out and publicize it when they were able. Staged hospital visits, complete with photographs in those first few months of the pregnancy, and then again right after the birth, which happened overseas. When Gigi's husband died, Gerald and Nina saw an opportunity to bring their daughter home without a scandal.
But their affair was an open secret, I point out. I mean, even Dove Franklin knew about it.
Yes, but back then, having an affair was one thing. Maybe everyone wasn't doing it, but loads of people in Gerald and Nina's circles were. Not to mention all the showmances of the era. But Gerald was raised Catholic and was never going to subject Rosalind to a divorce. And even if he had been willing, the timeline wouldn't have borne out, and Ruth would have been the one to suffer. Nina didn't want that for her daughter, and neither did Gerald. So they split up. She married someone else, he raised their daughter as his niece, and they were only ever in the same room again the week Ruth got married. He gave up the woman he loved to be the father he should have been the first time around. And Nina.
Margaret's voice settles into a flat, matter-of-fact tone.
Well, she gave up everything.
The words seem to echo around us. It takes me close to a minute to muster a reply. Did Ruth know? Margaret's gaze falls.
No. You remember what happened in the end to Ruth Allen and her husband.
My heart clenches. I can picture the headlines and the black and white photographs so clearly. Their small plane mangled on a jetty south of San Francisco. It was a tragedy. Margaret's throat bobs.
I always thought the worst part was she was so much more than that. She was smart and wickedly funny, and so kind she'd stop to help a caterpillar onto a branch before the gardener cut our lawns. More than anyone I know, she lived her short life in raging color, and all she's remembered for is what she didn't get to do.
Maybe by strangers, I say, but not by the people who knew her. And someday, everyone who reads your story will have the chance to know the real Ruth, the truth. A sad smile passes over Margaret's lips.
Maybe.
She takes a long sip of lemonade, then sets it back in its ring of condensation and looks at me, shielding her face against the sun.
A few years after Ruth's wedding, Nina Gill came to Gerald and begged him to finally tell their daughter the truth. Nina was sick, actually sick, lung cancer. In the 50s, the prognosis for that wasn't so hot. Somehow, she managed to get Gerald to agree. But they never got the chance. The weekend of my 16th birthday, LP, Ruth,
she corrects herself,
and James were flying down to the House of Ives, and their plane malfunctioned on takeoff.
Margaret clears her throat.
Hard not to feel like it was the truth that killed her. Like even the universe had bought Gerald's lie, but once it figured out that Ruth Allen was well and truly Ruth Ives, her happiness couldn't be allowed to continue.
I swallow, emotion tightening my windpipe. Do you believe that? That your family is cursed?
No, honey.
The flash of a smile doesn't reach her once sparkling blue eyes.
My family is the curse.
An alarm goes off on her phone then, cracking the moment in half.
Ah, she says, eyeing the screen. Time for my massage.
I clear my throat, emerging from the dark cloud of her story and reacclimating to this reality. A day full of sunshine, the smell of salt water and grass and pine, a world in which massages and mint lemonade are at your fingertips instead of loss and sorrow.
I thought you didn't leave the property, I say.
I don't, usually,
she says. So Jody knows shiatsu, I guess. She cackles at this.
Good lord, that wouldn't surprise me, but no. We have a routine. A gal comes to the house. I'm already lying on my stomach by the time she gets here.
And that works? She's never seen your face? I say, my skepticism only mounting. Her narrow shoulders lift.
Maybe a glimpse or two across the years, but she's young. I doubt she'd have any idea who I was. Doubt anyone would. The world's moved on.
That's not true, I say. For all Margaret knows, this massage therapist is Linda, who emailed me the tip about Margaret's life down here. A tip whose origins Margaret insisted she had no guess at when I first tracked her down. I'm about to suggest as much when Margaret pushes herself up onto her feet.
It is true, she says, adamant. The world moved on, just like I hoped it would.
On Wednesday morning, I step out into the thick mist and immediately kick something sitting on the walkway. A cup of iced coffee, now toppled onto its side and leaking onto the stone, beside a paper bag. I crouch to pick them up, heart floating upward at the chocolate croissant inside the bag and the words scribbled on the outside of the coffee cup. Friends? I carry my bounty with me to the driveway and head toward downtown. The gallery that carries Margaret's wind chimes and mosaics sits between a seafood shack and an ice cream shop, one block from the water. And because this is a world of retirees and vacationers, it hardly matters that it's late morning on a weekday. The shop is crowded with women in sun hats, men in sandals, and teenagers either glued to their phones or surreptitiously checking each other out. I fight a smile as I pass a couple of sunburnt ladies excitedly cooing over a darling little turtle mosaic. Not one of Margaret's, of course. But there is a large rectangular one framed in the dead center of the back wall, a spiral of pale blues, the shade so similar that you can't quite see the pattern until you squint. And when I do, it's like one of those old magic eyes, a clear path coming into focus. Unicursal. With one way in and out. I find it strange that someone like Margaret, who comes from a family so thoroughly ensconced in history and culture, would be drawn to this idea that no matter what you do, you'll end up in the same place. It would be much easier for me to imagine her strangely specific upbringing shaping her into the kind of person who fancies herself the master of her own fate. Then again, maybe suffering the kind of loss she has makes a person need to yield some control, to stop asking what could I have done differently, and just accept that this is the path she's on. One that started with a man who tried to control the world with money, and then one who tried to control it with the written word, and eventually led to her and Cosmo Sinclair in a doomed car chase. Maybe it's a kind of comfort to her to believe she was never the one in the driver's seat. Even that day, even when she lost the love of her life in a stupid, preventable accident.
This one's underappreciated.
I jump at the voice just over my shoulder and turn to find the shopkeeper smiling up at me, her curly hair held back from her freckled face with a neon green headband to reveal large wooden hoop earrings. Is it for sale? I ask her.
Technically, she says. But I can't bring myself to drop the price any lower. I love it too much, so it will probably live here for the rest of its days.
How much? I ask.
$2,300, she says.
I try not to flinch, which makes her crack a smile.
Yep, that's the usual reaction I get, she says. It's not exactly the kind of thing you buy as a vacation memento, but I thought someone would at least want it for their vacation home down here.
She leans toward me conspiratorially.
You interested?
Currently, I don't even have a wall big enough for this, I say, let alone the money to buy it. Who's the artist?
Her name's Irene Mayberry, she says. A local. A gruff sort, not very chatty, but she's a true artist.
Not to be a plebeian, I say, but how exactly can you tell? She screws up her mouth as she thinks.
I think what it is that just from looking at it, You can tell she had a reason for making it. I mean, aside from making it to sell, you know. A lot of the people I work with, I'd consider artisans. They're great at their craft, and they make things they love, and that they know my customers will love, and that's extremely valuable. But there's another way of making things, too. Irene's stuff, every time I look at it, I can't help but feel like she was trying to find something, or maybe get somewhere. Like she was just bushwhacking through a very dense forest because something she just had to know lay on the other side. She flashes a knowing smile. Oh, who knows? Maybe she's a total charlatan and I'm an easy mark. Either way, I like it. Me too, I say honestly. Do you have any smaller ones, or more specifically, cheaper ones? She chuckles and jerks her head toward the opposite wall. I might have just the thing. I follow her to a much smaller mosaic, no larger than 5 inches by 5 inches, the slivers of glass so small they must have been pieced together with tweezers and a magnifying glass, and, unlike every other piece I've seen of Margaret's, composed of amber, red, translucent gold, a tiny, tight spiral that almost looks like a galaxy. 250, the shopkeeper says. Then I see the tiny penciled title at the bottom right corner, just inside the frame. Beside Margaret's assumed initials, her own in reverse, in her own handwriting, Nicolette. I'll take it, I say. 15. Normally, I don't have trouble sleeping, but Thursday arrives, for me, well before the sun rises. And no matter how many times I turn over beneath the top sheet, the bed feels too warm and I can't drift back off. Around 4:30, I finally flick on the bedside lamp, the buttery glow hitting the tiny framed mosaic sitting just beneath it. Nicolette, the one you'd give it all up for. But what does that mean for Margaret? 20 years ago, she walked out of her life and became a different person. Why? What the shopkeeper cum gallerist said comes back to me. She was trying to find something, or maybe get somewhere. Voice croaky with sleep, I whisper, "What are you trying to find?" I slide out of bed and get dressed. The hotel is back in the other direction from Little Croissant, but I've got plenty of time to kill before I'm set to meet with Margaret, so I drive through the wee hours of the gray morning with my windows down. The sea air cycloning through the car. It's a good day, I think. I'd wondered if Hayden had also relocated from the hotel, but when I pull into the quiet parking lot, I spot his car right away. After parking, I lean into the back seat and dig through my backpack until I find a Sharpie, then pluck the green tea from the cup holder, poised to write on its damp side. I debate for a second which missive to leave for him and settle on jotting down my phone number. That seems like a decisive reply to the question he left on mine. Friends? I run it up to his door and make it back to the car before 6 a.m., a full 2 hours before I need to be at Margaret's. Now what? I say aloud. The sound of the waves crashing against the shore behind the hotel answers me. I've been so absorbed in the Margaret of it all that I actually haven't been down to the beach since my first couple of days here. And that was at the peak of the afternoon, when the tourists nearly outweighed the sand. Now I leave my stuff in the car, roll the windows up, and take the wooden walkway between the Grand Lucia and the next resort over, through the dunes and down toward the water. A sign warns of venomous snakes in the dune grass, and I find myself treating the walkway like a tightrope, sticking to the very center, just in case. The tall pockets of wispy grass dwindle as I get closer to the water and then drop away entirely, the platform ramping downward toward open beach. At the end of the walkway, I slip my sandals off and step into the sand. It's surprisingly cool between my toes, though the air is already dense with humidity. The first glow of the rising sun is peeking over the gray-green waves, seagulls cutting stark silhouettes overhead as they squawk across the sky. A silver-haired woman in a windsuit is my only company, trawling along the lip of the tide with a metal detector.
I perch atop a long, thick piece of bone-white driftwood, enjoying the stillness and the quiet, trying and failing to take a few phone pictures that might come close to capturing the feeling of energy and possibility that emanates from all around, the beach, the water, the sky. On my phone, it's a blur of blue-black pixels. The most beautiful things never hold up on a screen. That, I think, is why I became a writer instead of a photographer. I'd had a phase back when we were kids and Audrey was still sick. For the first couple of years that I was aware, really aware of what she was dealing with, and of the very real possibility that we could lose her, I remember spending all my time worrying. And then one year, for Christmas, my parents gave me a camera. And instead of useless worrying, I began instead to catalog her, to stockpile every happy memory for later. Like if I had enough pictures of her, of our whole family, then I'd be able to reconstruct her if I had to. Or maybe I'd capture enough of her soul to keep her here. Except I was bad at it. Terrible. So to supplement my visual log, I began to journal too. I stopped worrying so much, channeled all my frustration and helplessness into documenting. And whenever I was scared, I'd go back to my favorite entries and reread what I'd written. And I'd feel like I really was there. All the emotions and sensations of the moment would rise, an echo, or a kind of time travel. With writing, you could always add more, 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 until you got to the heart of a thing, and after that, you could chip away the excess. With photography, you had to get it right the first time. I didn't have the patience for that, or the faith in myself, if I'm being honest. I liked the security of revision. She was trying to find something, or maybe get somewhere, I think again. It's not dissimilar to why I started writing, or why I still do it. Not just the pursuit of some clinical truth, but the need to understand a person, to make sense of what's at their very core, closest to their heart, to present that clearly, truthfully, and to preserve it. Across the water, the sun inches higher. Brilliant gold ripples toward me, bouncing across the choppy surface of the waves. Then red, orange, white, pink. If the cool, moody tones of morning represent promise and potential, then these are that of hope, of a dream being realized. The colors, it occurs to me, of the tiny mosaic on the side table in my rented bedroom.
I suppose we should back up.
Margaret shouts over her shoulder at me. She has to shout to be heard over the roar of the airboat as she guides it through the murky reeds behind her property. She's letting me record today, but transcribing the recording later is going to be a nightmare with all this ambient sound, and I suspect that dousing ourselves in bug repellent before we boarded was also a fool's errand, because the mosquitoes seem to be taking our precautions as a challenge rather than a deterrent. I've slapped 4 off me within the first 10 minutes.
It might be easier if we stopped for a while, I shout.
What?
Margaret shouts, proving my point.
It might be easier if...
She cuts the propeller, and the sounds of the marsh swell to replace it. Dropping my voice to a more reasonable volume, I say,
Could we just drift for a little bit while we talk?
We'll get eaten alive, she says.
Just for a little bit, I say.
She adjusts her sun hat and sprays some more repellent on her arms.
Do you take the boat out often? I ask.
Fairly often, she says. I find some of the best trash here.
She hefts a net up from the base of the boat.
Bottles, plates, mugs, you name it. It's my favorite spot to scavenge.
What about the beach? I say. Do you go there often?
We don't have much of an off-season, she says. So occasionally, sure, but mostly I just let Jody bring me back whatever she finds there.
Does she go often? I ask, more out of personal curiosity than anything.
Loads, she says.
I think about my new mosaic, Nicolette, and how much the sunrise over the water reminded me of it. I guess sunrise over a beach is just one more thing Margaret gave up. The question is why.
So now that we've talked about your great-grandfather and your grandfather, I was thinking we could talk about your dad, I say. Frederick Ives was born in, I glance through my notes.
In 1904, she supplies, a second before I find the same number in my barely legible handwriting. And his sister, Francine, was born the next year. And like I told you earlier, my grandfather was initially determined to give his children the freedom and ease that his own strict childhood had lacked. They more or less ran wild as kids, and then Gerald abandoned them for Hollywood when they were teenagers.
Right. It's going to be tricky to keep all of this straight. The book will need a family tree up front, with dates for easy reference. So, Frederick is 1904, Francine is 1905, and then Ruth Allen is born in secret in, I check my notes, 1928 or 29?
I'm not sure which, Margaret confirms. They flubbed her birthday by a few months, I'm sure, just to make the lies more convincing.
And then they all end up living together. Gerald, his wife, Rosalind, and his sister, Gigi, Gigi's adopted daughter, Ruth, who's actually Gerald and Nina's biological daughter, plus Gerald's older children, Francine and Frederick, your father, who are 26 and 27 at that point?
Sounds about right, she agrees.
So before the whole family reunited, what were Francine and Frederick up to in San Francisco? I ask.
Still running wild. Their mother spent most of her time invested in various philanthropic efforts. This was during the Great Depression, after all. But neither her son nor daughter had much interest in work of any kind. So they'd become known eccentrics, spending their estranged father's money like it was a contest. Francine was obsessed with showing dogs and horses. At one point, she owned over 20 dogs and 50 horses.
Dear Lord, I say, if I could whistle, I would.
Margaret chuckles at this. She had a dozen trainers on retainer, but was also constantly firing and replacing them. She also, if my father is to be believed, which is a rather large if, treated them like a stable of lovers. She was constantly falling in love, hiring the objects of her eye, then falling out of love and eventually firing them or driving them to quit.
Yikes, I say. That sounds like
a lawsuit waiting to happen.
She snorts a laugh, then unscrews the cap on the bottle of water at her feet, taking a long glug. The sun is high, and I've become drenched through in sweat without noticing it happening. I open my bottle, too, and chug, then swipe the sweat from my eyes.
And your father, he was gambling, mostly, she says. His idiosyncrasies were more about what he'd bet with.
This I've read about. Physical labor instead of money, right? Her chin dips, her mouth tight with distaste.
Money was of so little consequence to him that I guess losing or winning it didn't provide much of a thrill. He preferred to play with humiliation on the line. He once had the third wealthiest man in San Francisco mucking out his sister Francine's overly bloated stables for a week, and he found himself on the other end of those situations plenty too.
How did your father get people to agree to these kinds of terms? I ask.
Honey, you haven't been around many exorbitantly wealthy people, have you? She says. I've interviewed lots of actors and singers, I disagree.
Oh, that's different, she says. That's fast money. Money a person finds. The people who are born with it, they're different.
You were born with it, I point out.
That's how I know, she says. Remember, I was married to Cosmo Sinclair. I knew someone like your usual interview subject. Cosmo's family had nothing. He never got used to the money or the attention. He was afraid that either he'd burn through the former or the latter would burn through him. More like Lawrence.
Another one of her sad smiles, the kind that still makes her eyes seem flinty.
Cosmo missed it, the life he couldn't go back to, all the time. But I couldn't miss it because I could barely imagine it.
Hearing her talk about him makes me feel like there's a hook in my heart, and I'm eager to be reeled in to hear more about their love and their life together.
I was a news story from the moment I was born, she goes on. From before my first breath, there were two distinct Margaret Iveses. There was me, and then there was the other one who belonged to the public,
who got written about, who people loved at times and hated at others, and no matter where I stood with the public, I understood that it wasn't really me. I was just a character the press made up. For Cosmo, he was splintered. His fame came on hard and fast, and once he got tangled up with me, it only got worse. Every bad thing that every perfect stranger said about him mattered, because he wasn't used to discounting it. He was used to people's opinions of him having been formed by, well, him. His actions and intentions, their personal experience with him. It was killing him long before the accident.
She peers across the marsh, losing herself in the haze of memory. I want to reach out and touch her hand, comfort her, be a friend to her. But I'm not, not yet. And I can't be one more person projecting my knowledge of the iconic tabloid princess into belief that I actually truly know her. So instead, I let her sit, take her time, hoping she knows it belongs to her, that I don't consider it mine just because of who she is. She blinks, facing me again.
Anyway, it wasn't hard for my father to talk men of absurd wealth into absurd bets. He enjoyed his ridiculous life in San Francisco, and his sister, Francine, did too, right up until the moment Gerald sent for them. Neither had any interest in joining their father in Los Angeles, but not a single penny they'd been spending was truly theirs. So, in the end, they had no choice. At first, my father and my Aunt Francine tried to resume their previous lifestyles, but Gerald was down to business then. He decided it was time for his kids to get serious too, or risk being cut off. He wanted Francine to get married and my father to learn the family business. The irony was, Aunt Francine had decided she didn't ever want to get married. She felt so strongly about it that she decided her best bet was to try to earn a place in the family business instead, whereas the only thing my father felt strongly about was doing as little work as humanly possible. Dad thought he could skate by if he started working at the film studio, so Gerald set him up there, and Francine took over a failing ladies' magazine. There had been women journalists there for years, but she was the first female co-editor-in-chief. Then editor-in-chief when the co-editor quit. Years later, she told me she knew in her heart that when her father gave her that journal, the point was to scare her into marriage. Instead, she worked hard to learn the business, and she turned it around. She had something my father lacked.
I ask, and what was that?
Desperation, she says. My father didn't find his until later.
The story. Their version. Frederick Ives was a jealous man. Her version. Frederick Ives was a jealous man. As a boy, he was jealous of his schoolmates, of their grades, of their success in sports, of their teachers' affection for them, and sometimes even of the ire they could inspire. At home, he was jealous every time his sister Francine took the seat at the head of the dinner table, and when he started arriving early so he could have it, he was jealous of how casually late she'd stroll in, still covered in mud from the stables, how unbothered she seemed by their mother's disapproval. When he was 20, a girl who'd spent weeks batting her eyelashes at him got engaged to another man, and though he had no intention of marrying her, he was jealous then, too. At 27, when his long-absent father forced him to relocate to the castle he'd built on the coast, Freddie was jealous of his half-orphaned cousin Ruth, of the delight she seemed to cause her Uncle Gerald and the careful structure to her life, which neither of Freddie's parents had ever bothered to give Freddie as a boy. He was born with enough money to buy himself almost anything, and so all he ever wanted was the things he couldn't. He was jealous, too, when Francine found something new to want in the form of success at Hearth and Home Journal, and when she strong-armed the business back into the black, proving herself as their father's true heir. He tried to want Royal Pictures, to want the sleek, wood-paneled corner office he'd been given for no good reason, and frankly spent many afternoons napping in. He tried to want the secretary, Shelley, he'd been assigned, and then promptly began sleeping with. About twice a week, she informed him of a new meeting set by his father, and he quickly learned that these were the negotiations for contracts Gerald didn't actually care about securing. He brushed off actors, writers, and directors onto his son with regularity, and just as Gerald hoped, Freddie bungled those talks time and again with his total lack of knowledge about the business. Even though he knew this was the role he was set to fulfill, it made Freddie feel incompetent, and he didn't like feeling incompetent. Lazy? Sure. Incompetent? No. It was a matter of control. He was asleep at his desk, face plastered to a stack of unread scripts, on which he'd been supposed to write notes last week, when Doris Bernhardt stormed into his office one day in 1935.
"So this is what I'm worth?" she demanded, marching right up to him. "I make him a pretty penny and he shunts me off to the deadbeat son?"
Freddie's secretary came rushing in next, slowed down by her kitten heels, and never had he seen such a stark contrast between two women. Shelley was dainty, bird-boned, with auburn hair and lush lips that matched her lush hips. She wore a long skirt that swished with every step she took and had a habit of toying with the necklace she wore around her delicate throat. Doris Bernhardt was tall, angular, with thin lips and narrow hips. She wore flat shoes and wide-legged trousers and not a lick of makeup that he could see. She had to be nearly 30 years old, but he doubted she would have had leading lady potential even if she were younger.
"Mr. Ives," Shelley said, oozing apology, "I tried to tell Ms. Bernhardt."
Ms. Bernhardt rolled her eyes.
"Oh, yes, she told me about how busy you are this morning. She insisted I come back next week for my scheduled meeting, but I had a feeling you'd be able to squeeze me in between some of your other important appointments."
Shelley gaped at him, helpless. He became aware, abruptly, that if he didn't take control, he was automatically ceding it to Bernhardt.
"Thank you, Shelley," he said. "I'm happy to speak with Ms. Bernhardt. Hold my calls."
He never really got calls, but it felt like the right thing to say, like it might give him back a fraction of his power, which suddenly seemed absolutely essential. Shelley wavered.
"Goodbye, Shelley," he said coolly,
and she finally retreated. He waited a second, just stared Bernhardt down. She stared right back, jaw set.
"Would you care to sit?"
he asked. She snorted, then slowly walked behind his desk and took his chair. He fought a smile. Rather than sitting across from her in one of the slightly lower chairs positioned there, he rounded the desk too and leaned against it, arms crossed.
"So what would you care to speak to the deadbeat son about?"
"Nothing," she said. "I wish to speak to Gerald Ives about a new contract."
"What about it exactly?"
he asked, because he, of course, had not yet read the new contract being proposed to her and did not, in fact, even know who she was.
"Well, for one thing," she said, "I'd like to know why I'm being offered less money for a longer term when I've already been benched for the last 6 months. Is he trying to send me running to Universal?"
Of course he was, but for some reason, Freddie wasn't supposed to admit this.
"You know," he said instead, "it's not uncommon for actresses around your age to see fewer opportunities in this business."
"Actresses my age?" she spat at him, lunging to her feet.
"I don't mean any offense," he said, "but you've got to be realistic here."
She tipped her head back on a throaty laugh before leveling her fiery gaze on him.
"I've got to be realistic," she repeated. "I've got to be realistic. Yes, of course, I've got to be realistic. I'm one of two female directors this studio has ever worked with. I'm acutely aware of my reliance upon realism at all times, whereas someone like you, someone raised in a castle and handed a job he doesn't do in an industry he knows nothing about, need never trouble himself with anything so mundane as realism."
"You're a director?" he said.
The question triggered her derisive snorting instinct.
"You're a woman," he reminded her.
"Yes, I believe my speech touched on that," she said.
Have you directed anything I've seen? He asked.
Her face went red with anger.
I should hope so, given your position at Royal Pictures.
She named three of her films. One he'd never heard of, two he'd seen, and of those two, one was a smash hit.
Why would he be trying to get rid of you? He asked.
Most of the time, he understood his father's decisions. Ms. Bernhardt snorted again and waved down her length with a flourish.
Because of your dreadful wardrobe? Freddie said, flummoxed,
and he saw the first flash of what Doris Bernhardt looked like when she was smiling. Like a cat with three canaries lined up in its jaw, little yellow feathers sticking out in a row. He couldn't look away, could barely stand a blink and miss a second of that expression.
I don't have much sway here, Miss Bernhardt, he said.
Bernie, she interjected.
Bernie, he said. As you pointed out, I do very little and know even less about this industry, and as for my father, well, he may have built a castle, but I assure you I wasn't raised anywhere near either it or him. But you're right that offering you less money is insulting after what you've brought in. I'd be insulted too, which might be the point. But if I had to guess, and of course I do, it has less to do with willfully insulting you and more to do with taking a gamble that you won't walk, because you can't. Because Universal and MGM won't want you. He found you. He gave you your chance and cultivated your talent, and now he thinks he can get you for cheaper than you're worth, because very likely he can.
With another angry huff, she threw out her arms.
So it doesn't matter that I've proven myself again and again in this business?
He arched an eyebrow at her.
Judging from what I've heard from the many women I've come to know in the business, this is the industry standard. It's realistic.
She collapsed back into the chair, a look of exhaustion sweeping over her, and though she was tall and angular, she looked delicate then. He both wanted to comfort her and suspected she would sock him in the jaw for his trouble. He cleared his throat.
I will ask him, though. I'll plead your case.
Her gaze narrowed warily.
Why?
With total honesty, he answered,
Because I want your next movie. I want it here, at Royal Pictures.
She surveyed him for a long moment, then rose from the chair.
Thank you for your time, she said, not with deference, but not with sarcasm either. But I won't be renewing my contract with Royal.
She turned and walked from the room, and Freddie felt that loss, that emptiness, that moroseness he sometimes awoke to in the morning, multiplied tenfold. He wanted something. He wanted something he couldn't name, and so couldn't reach out and take. After that, he was a goner. 16.
My mother, Margaret says, was a magnificent woman.
Everything I've ever read about her agrees, I say quietly. Matching Margaret's volume, trying not to jerk her from the memory fogging over her eyes. I want her to linger. We finally reached the people who shaped her most, and I want to stay here.
My father loved her, she says. Dearly. It's important that you know that.
I nod, my pen going motionless in my hand.
Because so much of the news was about their divorce, she says. And what they wrote about him was true. He loved her, but he didn't treat her like he loved her. At the time, I couldn't make sense of this, but now I understand it perfectly.
Could you explain it to me, then? I press.
He didn't love himself, she says simply. I know how trite that sounds. Even hearing it come out of my mouth, a part of me is thinking, Margaret, get a grip. He was a weak, jealous man. But then I remember the early days, and it breaks apart that easy, clean-cut story. He adored her. He adored all of us. You know they spoke on the phone every single day until she died.
I'd heard that, yes, I say, but I didn't know if it was true.
They were best friends, she says. That's how it started, and that's what they got back to, eventually.
Well, not how it started, I point out. You did just tell me she tore him a new one the first time they met. Her lips part on a grin.
That was his favorite story to tell. She'd chime in with, I thought he was a real prick.
So what changed then? I ask.
Well, she got her MGM contract, for one thing. And when word got out, he sent her a huge bouquet, which she didn't care for. She hated seeing cut flowers.